Welcome. My name's Mallory Factor, and I'm going to be your guide through the conservative intellectual tradition in America. Our speaker today will be talking about the New Deal. He is an expert on the New Deal. He's written a host of books on the New Deal, including FDR Goes to War, which is brand new, and The New Deal or Raw Deal. So we will learn a lot from him. He currently holds the Charles Klein Chair in History and Management at Hillsdale College in Hillsdale, Michigan. And he's a senior fellow in economic education for the Mackinac Center for Public Policy. He serves also as a senior historian at the Foundation for Economic Education, FEE, and writes a quarterly column for FEE's publication, The Freeman, which we'll learn a little more about as we go a little further along in this course. He's published 7 books, and these books revise the commonly held views about the role of capitalism in the social development of the Industrial Revolution and the Gilded Age. These books also include Urban Capitalists, The Myth of the Robber Barons, as well as how FDR's economic legacy has damaged America and empire builders. He's written for a host of publications, from the Wall Street Journal to Investor's Business Daily. He's appeared on numerous television shows, including Glenn Beck, which he was just on yesterday, and Fox and Friends, and numerous shows on C-SPAN as well. It gives me a great deal of pleasure to introduce our next speaker, Dr. Burton Folsom, Jr.
Thank you, Mallory. I'm glad to be here talking about President Franklin D. Roosevelt. As you know, president in the 1930s, during the Great Depression, he had a program called the New Deal, a series of programs, actually. How many of you, in growing up in classes, heard things about Franklin Roosevelt, the Great Depression, and the New Deal? Any in the audience, of course, many of our students? Well, let me ask our cadets here and expand the question to our audience generally. How many of you, in going through your classes, high school and beyond, generally had professors who were favorable to Franklin Roosevelt and the New Deal? Most of the cadets here, quite a few of the guests. Right. It would be the same here. Maybe I'd ask a different question. How many of you had parents who were favorable to Franklin Roosevelt? Fewer, interestingly. But still, in the classroom, the textbooks, all of this, he ranks very high, almost always within the top 3 in presidential polls. The Schlesinger poll, the most common poll, he got a great rating, the highest rating that can be given to any president by every historian who did the poll except for one, and that historian had him is up there, but just not great. So we have a top-ranking president. And the idea, the philosophy here is, in a general sense, you have a depression. We have unemployment, 20%, sometimes 25%. Very high, double-digit unemployment. You have, the idea is, if you put people to work, by the way, what are the names, some of the cadets may know, what are the names of some of Roosevelt's programs? Do you remember that were part of the New Deal? Yes, sir.
Works Project Administration?
Yes. Works Projects Administration. It actually had a double name, Works Progress Administration, but at one time it was Works Progress Projects Administration.
Tennessee Valley Authority.
Tennessee Valley Authority. TVA, you have the WPA. Right. Those are big ones. And, yes, sir.
Civilian Conservation Corps.
CCC. Anita, my wife, who and co-author, who I am very dependent upon in my work, her father, His first job with the CCC, Civilian Conservation Corps. Yes. These and other programs, you see the idea. You have unemployment, you put people to work in the CCC, the WPA, you do work with river reclamation and this sort of thing. You do with the TVA, electricity and this kind of thing. And all of a sudden, jobs are generated, in the case of the WPA, for people doing the road building or people doing the building of construction projects, hospitals, schools, this kind of thing. Then that puts people to work. They spend money. And you get out of the Great Depression, ultimately. In other words, you have spending, and then you get recovery. How many heard that formulation in school? Mallory, let me have the New Dealer audio, this one. Here is what Henry Morgenthau, Secretary of Treasury, Roosevelt's own Secretary of Treasury, said about the New Deal. It was 7 years into the New Deal, 1939. He was looking at the unemployment statistics and he saw they were 20.7%. 7 years after Roosevelt's elected, unemployment statistics, 20.7%. And Morgenthau said this, "We have been spending money. We are spending more than we have ever spent before, and it does not work. And I have just one interest, and if I'm wrong, somebody else can have my job. I want to see this country prosperous. I want to see people get a job. I want to see people get enough to eat. We have never made good on our promises. I say, after 8 years of this administration, we have just as much unemployment as when we started, and an enormous debt to boot." That is spoken by one of President Roosevelt's best friends. The man who made that statement had a picture of himself and Roosevelt side by side. Roosevelt signed it and said, "From one of two of a kind." They had lunch together, breakfast together. They would pass notes to each other sometimes at cabinet meetings. That is what that man said about the New Deal. In frustration, after 7 years, it had not worked. And somebody's saying, are you saying that when you have high unemployment and you pump money into the economy by the WPA and these various programs, that it doesn't work? Yes. I'm saying exactly that. Put it in your notes. That's exactly what I'm saying. And I'm going to try to explain it here in three parts today by looking at the 1920s, by looking at the 1930s, and then by looking at the war and the end of the war to try to illustrate how the spending on recovery, the stimulus package approach, is an optical illusion, as we saw demonstrated in the New Deal. All of that spending, massive record spending on these programs, and we had double-digit unemployment every year after putting those programs into effect for the rest of the 1930s. Let's start with the 1920s. I wanted to start there because it's a good illustration. Then go to the 30s. So step one, the 20s. Step two, the 1930s. And then look a little bit at the 40s as well as we finish the Roosevelt presidency. The 1920s. What we had coming out of World War I was something similar to what we had going into the 1930s, and that is high unemployment. And the reason we had it, World War I had ended. 4 million soldiers are out, coming home from being on the battlefields in Europe. They come home, they can't get a job. We had high taxes in place, and the argument there that President Wilson had was it was to pay for the war. And so we have high taxes, entrepreneurs are not really getting into business very much, and we have 12% unemployment. Right now, current unemployment indicators are 8.3, 8.5% in that vicinity. Now, we're talking here about 12% unemployment. So we had double-digit unemployment in 1921. It becomes the issue in the 1920 campaign. And in the 1920 campaign, can anybody help me who won the election in 1920? Who was president? You're right, Matt. It is Coolidge, vice president. And who's the president? Harding. You know, I find this interesting because they are hard to remember. I mean, I don't hold you people in check for this because these are not well-known presidents. Matt got Coolidge, and he was vice president. Warren G. Harding was president. You don't think of those presidents very much, do you? They came in 1920, and the idea was, well, what are you going to do about this unemployment that we've got here? And there were even suggestions. Why don't we need? What we need is a gigantic stimulus package. See, and here's the logic. Listen to the logic. The automobile is becoming a universal acquisition for everybody. Just about everybody has an automobile, but the roads aren't very good because formerly we were doing horses and buggies and that kind of thing. You need different surfacing, of course, for cars. And so what you do is you have cars, and we don't have a lot of that surfacing. So why don't we put these soldiers returning home from the war to work building roads? And then we'll put them to work, and they'll plow money into the economy, and we'll get out of this 12% unemployment. Harding said no. Coolidge said no. The argument was interesting. They said, number one, it's unconstitutional. Now, that right there is a shocker, isn't it? They were reading the Constitution, Article 1, Section 8, and discovered nowhere in the Constitution does it give the federal government the power to put money into place for roads. And there's a reason for that. And James Madison explained that when he gave a veto of a bill in 1817. Madison and Jefferson, those old-style agrarians, said you could obviously then, if you had that power of the federal government for road building, plow it into your home state or states where you wanted votes, and that isn't what we want to do. Why not have the states in charge of the road building? Yes, we want roads. We just don't think the federal government ought to be the place where it's done. And so what we had is state and local road building. Harding said it worked for Jefferson and Madison, it works for me. He also said and believed that it wouldn't work. Because if you build a road and you put people to work, that's nice, but where do you get the money to do it? That's the key question. What you see is the road being built, and you see former soldiers at work building the road. What you don't see is the money that is taken from taxpayers to build the road. And those taxpayers could have spent the money on other things. Maybe actually they would have wanted to build roads too, but the point is it would have been their choice. And that makes an interesting question. Who better spends money, government bureaucrats or you? And who is more likely to spend money on things that are really items that people would really want? We recognize roads are going to have to be built. It should be done at the state and local level. At the federal level, we keep the government out and limited. We keep taxation limited. People spend their own money. And so people said, well, is this the politics of no? And Harding, oh, no, two programs, two parts of the program. It's just that it's not a stimulus package approach. Number one, we cut federal spending. Number two, we cut tax rates, income tax rates. Now, that's interesting. This is the reverse of the stimulus package. You have high unemployment, so what do? You cut back federal spending, and you cut the income tax, and in effect, more people are going to have money to spend as they see fit. And Harding and Coolidge's argument is that will get us out of this Great Depression of 1920 and 1921. The interesting thing about being a historian is we get to look and see what happened. We know what happened. We have 12%. Let me tell you this. First of all, Harding and Coolidge, true to their word, Harding dies in office, so Coolidge will come in and fulfill his program. They cut federal spending by roughly 50% in the first 2 years of Harding's presidency, from roughly $6 billion a year to $3 billion a year. A 50% cut in federal spending, and they cut the federal income tax, the top rate, from 73%. They cut it down to, this is the top rate, and that's pretty high. I mean, that's three out of every $4 at the top level. And they cut that down to 56%, and they were eventually going to get it down to 25%. So what you see, income tax rates going down, federal spending going down, and unemployment's at 12%. The question is, what is unemployment 2 years later? The answer, 2%. Now, I want to be technical and use the official figure of the U.S. Bureau of Census, 2.4%. So I rounded down. Shame on me. 2.4%, or rounding it to the nearest percent, 2%. Unemployment in 1923, after 12% unemployment in 1921. And what you have, you sit there, well, what's going on here? What's going on is the beginning of one of the most prosperous decades in U.S. history. What we had is all of a sudden, tax rates are going down, federal spending's going down, and it's clear the direction we're headed. And they say, we're trusting entrepreneurs to make the difference. And what happened was a burst of entrepreneurship. We get to keep the money we make from the projects that we start. That's exciting. The 1920s, radio is invented and used and becomes a standard household item. It just sweeps in somewhat the way an iPhone is doing. Where, right? 6 years ago, hardly anybody has an iPhone, and 4 years from now, practically everybody will have one. Or at least a majority of people. That sweeping through the nation, radio had the same effect in the 1920s. But I'm not done with that. Here's some other changes. Tell me, here's one. Now, some of these are like sliced bread. You hear about the greatest invention since sliced bread? It was invented in the 20s. That's the beginning of the peanut butter and jelly sandwich. The 1920s. We had them before, but now we've got the sliced bread. Scotch tape. 1920s. We told people, you can invent a way. You get to keep what you make. Now, here's one. Do you think in Charleston, South Carolina, this invention would be of perhaps casual interest? Air conditioning. Air conditioning. And it was invented by a Yankee. Wouldn't you know it? Willis Carrier. He was hired by a firm in Brooklyn, which was a printing company. They were having problems with, they would print items and they would pile on one another and they would smear. The paper would smear, and they said, could we invent something to dehumidify the room more quickly? Because if we dehumidify the room more quickly, we won't get the smearing on the paper. And so he began to pull a lot of the humidity out of the room and had devices. And he noticed it had a cooling effect, see? But he puts that aside. You know, well, this is something that I might want to explore, that I could actually cool the room as well as dehumidify it. So he's playing around, but he went with his dehumidifier. And so now he's doing this in the 19-teens, and then we come into the 1920s, Willis Carrier, and he was trying to make some of these air conditioning contraptions. But when you're taxing someone 70%, you're in effect saying, if you succeed, three-fourths of everything you make past a certain point, that's a marginal rate, past a certain point, goes to the government. You get to keep a quarter. Well, he didn't think that was quite enough to make him take the risk. But then, when we begin to get the tax cuts, 1924, he begins to be more industrious with his sales. The first industry, the first group to buy an air conditioner. Now, this is interesting. You think about this. Who would be the first to buy an air conditioner? Any thoughts? The first to kind of product or group that would want that? I mean, Matt?
Movie theater?
Absolutely right. Cadet Salmaska's got it on the button. Movie theater! It used to be in the movie industry that the sales would be up here in the winter and then they'd drop in the summer because it would be so hot in the theater. The Rivoli Theater in New York City took a chance on Carrier's air conditioning and put it in. And it's kind of funny, they put it in and then all of a sudden they had big attendance and they're sitting there thinking, well, I wonder, it could be that the movie is so good. And, you know, they're doing kind of early exit polls. You know, well, what do you think? You know, they're asking people, what do you think of the movie today? And you get people saying, what movie? And I'm here for the movie. I'm here for, get out of that heat out there. And soon we had, by 1930, 6 years later, 300 movie theaters had air conditioning. Now, these were huge contraptions, multi-ton devices. And so it took a while. Then you get them into factories. Then, 1939, I regret to say, we put them in Congress, which kept them in session longer. So there are some negative unintended consequences of air conditioning. And then, of course, we get home units. I remember our first home unit. I grew up in Nebraska, so that we have not the hottest summers like we do here in South Carolina. But even then, it got hot enough in the summers. In 1962, we got our first air conditioner. And so home units began to become popular in the 1960s. So they become profitable. But you see, you have to start with big units. They become profitable. You figure out how to make small units. And by the 1960s, you have a lot of home units. And that starts air conditioning. But listen, the 1920s is full of inventions. I don't want to just stop there. We had talking movies. How many have seen the movie The Artist? Some of you? You got any? Well, that's a talking movie. You see an example of how movies once were, at least get some idea. And we go from movies that are silent movies, I should say, like The Artist. And then we have talking movies. But you get the studios ready to take the risk because you're telling them, if you make some money by giving people something that they want, and that's how you make money, give people something they want, then you get to keep most of the money you make. And when we told them that that was the deal, then we had invention, risk, and we're going to get the beginnings as we move toward modern-day movies, modern-day movie theater. So you get the air conditioning for the theater, you get the talking movies coming into the theaters. Another invention of the product of the 1920s is kind of interesting because probably everybody in this room is using it. No one was using it in 1920. We're all using it today. It went by the name, it had a Swedish inventor, Swedish-American, Gideon Sundback. He called his invention Hookless Number 2. Hookless Number 2. Today we know the invention as the zipper. The zipper. When he took his first Hookless Number 2 to the patent office, the patent guy was looking at him, used that, and said, hey, we're liberal in the way we dispense patents. I'm going to give you a patent for that. But I can't imagine a use for it. And so we have Hookless Number 2 coming into, but of course we aren't going to have it in the early 1920s because in the early 1920s we don't have tax rates that make it suitable for zipper companies to try to start. We get into the mid-1920s, all of a sudden we get B.F. Goodrich, took a chance on buying a couple hundred thousand Hookless Number 2s to make galoshes for women. They advertised it. They brought in Madison Avenue advertisers from New York, and they had a picture of a woman with her galoshes, or galosh if that's the singular or whatever. They had her up, and they had her with her fingers here, and the caption was, "Zip her up." And Hookless Number 2 went by the wayside. Zipper came into play, and instead of using buttons to button our clothes, zippers become increasingly popular. And there you have, now what's interesting about this 1920s phenomenon with all these inventions, the reduction of unemployment, the change in life, the growth in national product and prosperity and low unemployment, is that very little of this could we have anticipated. In other words, if you were to have asked Harding, well, what are these people going to invent that's going to make life so much better by the end of the decade? He couldn't have said, ha, 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 we're going to invent air conditioning, right? Or we're going to invent the zipper, so zip your lip. You know, we couldn't have had any of those kinds of conversations because he doesn't know what's going to work and what isn't. If we were to look at this, we find all sorts of contractions. People trying to do the old airplane with the wings. You know, we got all of this stuff that doesn't work, and some does. But in a market economy, we choose those products that we want to buy, and lo and behold, some of them were very good. And the 1920s becomes a decade of incredible inventiveness, and we see remarkable prosperity. And I want to just touch a minute on this because our Southern agrarians, Donald Davidson, Robert Penn Warren, and others, were not happy with this. They wrote their book, I'll Take My Stand, in 1930, after this great decade. And they say, industry is breaking down regionalism, and regionalism is wonderful, and there are parts of it that are. The radio means that you get communication all across the country. It's hard in Charleston to be isolated if you want to be with a radio because you get communication with the outside, exposure to the outside world. Air conditioning. To not want industry in progress in the way of industrial progress is to protect your regional culture in many ways, yes. It's also to do without many of the inventions and improvements that make our lives dramatically easier today. It's very easy for Professor Donaldson, Professor Davidson at Vanderbilt in Nashville, to say, well, these regional trends are no good. Well, what are you supposed to tell the people in Charleston, South Carolina, don't buy an air conditioner? How many would like to go through July and August here in Charleston with no air conditioning? Yeah. You also had as another invention of the 20s, was the development. It was invented before, but it came popular in the 20s. Like many of these invented before, but then you get the tax rates down and they become prominent in the 20s, is the refrigerator. We used to have an ice man come up and drop a big chunk of ice, and you had what was called an ice box, and you might put your plates and things on the ice in the ice box, but a refrigerator is a whole lot easier. You know, you don't have all that water and all of this, so a refrigerator becomes much more popular in the 1920s. These inventions were wonderful for the South. Anita and I spend part of our time each year in Atlanta, a city of 5 million. I wonder how big Atlanta would be without air conditioning. You get a city of 5 million, the change and the opportunities that they're able to offer people in the South is magnificent. True. The regionalism in the South breaks up, and I know there are complaints, the Yankees are coming down and moving in and all of this. It also provides opportunities in the South. And what we see today is the South and the economy of the South gradually, slowly but surely, surpassing the economy of the North. So much so that we're hearing that Alabama's economy is going to pass Michigan soon. That would have been unthinkable 30 and 40 years ago. Opportunities are there with industry. But it does break down regional barriers. The Southern agrarians valued regional barriers. And, you know, Davidson in his essay on the Old South and Charleston, you know, it's too bad when people are motivated solely by money. And I think that that's right. And the Bible tells us that the love of money is the root of all evil. But I'm not sure that if you're inventing an air conditioner and doing that you necessarily love money, you might. I mean, there are lots of things that go into that. You are self-interested, but there's an inventive that says, I want to change the world. I want to improve life. I want to help people. And that's part of it as well. And when you invent a product like that, lives are being saved. Lives are being saved. People are not going to have the kind of overheating and heat stroke that's going to take lives and put people in misery and make them unproductive. I can't imagine riding New Deal or Raw Deal in Charleston in the summer without air conditioning. I could never have written this book. It's only when I'm says, oh, gee, oh, I got to write and get me a nice cool iced tea or something by, or a soft drink or something. Now I can write. Well, yeah, those are the sorts of things that make it easier for us to do our daily job, and I'm grateful for those people. And I'm sorry that there are some advantages to regional boundaries that are good, but there are also some advantages to economic development and increasing opportunities and prosperity. And that's where I take issue with the Southern agrarians, and I frankly think that Madison and Jefferson, part of those old agrarian types, would have been very pleased to see their economies coming around in Virginia and other parts of the South and taking their place in the world as being industrial leaders. Now, Jefferson, I realize, very agricultural. He wanted an agricultural society. But to see your part of the world pursue economic development in an effective way is also very pleasing. Now, we get into the 1920s, and that takes us to the 1930s. Unfortunately, we had, under Herbert Hoover, a change. Even though Hoover was a Republican, and Harding and Coolidge were Republicans, Hoover was from a different wing of the Republican Party. He favored much more intervention. And he had the idea, well, I realize we'd get unemployment down to 2%, but I think we could use government to help make that even better. We had, and Hoover signed, the highest tariff in U.S. history, which in effect said, we're not going to buy watches from Switzerland, and we're going to put a high tariff on them so that we can sell local watches made in Massachusetts and Connecticut. Well, that's fine, except the Swiss don't sit around and say, oh, you know, we're selling watches. Back then, a watch was $2 or $3. He says, American watches, listen, American watches back in the 1920s were not only more expensive. Our watches were more like $4. Swiss watch was maybe $2 to $3. Our watches ran the hour in 58 minutes. In other words, they didn't keep very good time. We had to reset them in the morning. The Swiss watches kept better time, and they're cheaper. So Americans bought the Swiss watches. But American watchmakers lost the business. So we think, oh, let's put a tariff or a tax on imported Swiss watches, and then people will buy American. Well, that's nice, except the people in Switzerland, it's really sad to read about what happened in Switzerland. That's their major industry, watchmaking. They didn't just sit around and say, well, we'll just yodel in the hills to the sounds of music and get off our watchmaking business. On the contrary, they said, we're not buying American. So now American automobiles, which are competitive, American typewriters, now we're back to the air conditioning and all of these other inventions, all of that, no. They boycotted us. So now competitive American car makers are going to be shut off from Switzerland. You might say, well, Switzerland, that isn't that big a country. Well, this kind of thing that I'm using as an example, that happened all over Europe. We wouldn't buy British blankets. We wouldn't buy Spanish olives. And so all of a sudden, all over Europe, we're putting high tariffs on products that they sent to us. They wouldn't buy our materials. Some of this is reflected, for example, auto sales. 1929, great year, roaring 20s. We sold 5 million automobiles. 1933, we sold about 1.5 million automobiles. Now, there's more to it than just foreign sales, but that's a part of it. Foreign sales are down. And therein lies the problem. We hurt all of American industry through that kind of intervention. We also had the Federal Reserve raised interest rates, made it harder to borrow money. Milton Friedman won the Nobel Prize writing a book which described that and how it hurt the American economy. President Hoover raised tax rates. That made it harder for entrepreneurs to make a profit and less willing to take risks. Hoover's administration was a failure. And it's not surprising that Franklin Roosevelt beat him. Franklin Roosevelt ran promising to cut federal spending because he thought Hoover had gone way too far by taking a good economy and weakening that economy tremendously. Roosevelt came into power, though, and he changed his mind, and we can later discuss perhaps some of the motives in changing his mind, but here I want to say this. Roosevelt began pouring federal funds into the American economy, the equivalent of the modern-day stimulus package. Many of you have listed some of the programs that Roosevelt had. One of them, we'll talk about the WPA in a minute, one of these programs was called the AAA, Agricultural Adjustment Administration. And the idea here is farmers have low prices for the products they're making because people can't afford to buy much because unemployment's gotten over 20%. And so the idea was, hey, Roosevelt said, he came up with an idea. It is so wild. It's such a wild idea, it could only have been invented by a college professor. The idea was, let's pay farmers not to produce. I think that's secretly because college professors, we like to think of ourselves being paid not to produce. And sadly, the world would be a better place if we paid many college professors not to produce. But nonetheless, paying not to produce becomes part of the Agricultural Adjustment Act, the AAA, under Franklin Roosevelt. Now, the idea, see, you have low prices that the farmers are making, so if you pay them, here's the deal. You'll have them set aside as much as a fourth of their land, 25%, and then you'll pay them not to produce on that 25%. And that will be good because it'll get farm income up because they'll be getting money. And also, it will reduce the overproduction of corn and wheat and cotton and other farm products because the farmer will only be producing on three-fourths of his land because a fourth of it's out of circulation. Hey, that sounds wonderful. President Roosevelt discovered a most unpleasant development in Washington, D.C. Some farmers were taking this money not to produce and were sneaking crops on that land anyway and then trying to make double money, see? Solution. We send inspectors out to everybody's land. They're going to have measuring equipment, and they're going to go out and measure everybody's land and make sure if you have, say, a 160-acre farm, that 40 acres and exactly that are not farmed on. And if you do farm on them, we're going to make you dig it all up. Well, President Roosevelt can sit back in his chair and relax. And he heard something, again, most unpleasant news that came into Washington. That news was that some of the farmers were taking the money that they were receiving not to produce and bribing the inspector with some of that money to go to the next field. We have a solution. We send inspectors to inspect the inspectors. Then we had another group of inspectors, as we say, coming in to look at the land, and we found out that some of those inspectors were being bribed as well. With inspectors and inspectors inspecting the inspectors being bribed, the next step was to get a fleet of airplanes and go over everybody's land and take pictures of it. That way we can see if anybody's cheating or not. All of this for a farm program, and by the way, the Department of Agriculture became the second largest department in the federal government next to the defense, then the Department of War. Because of all of these employees who are going around the country inspecting farms and flying airplanes and taking pictures of all of this. Lo, and we discover in 1934 that some of the farmers had taken the money that they got from being paid not to produce and they used it to buy fertilizer for the other three-fourths and they had great production on the three-fourths, and some crops were actually up in production in 1934, ahead of what they were in 1933 and 32. Thus, the farm crisis persists. I say that because it gives you an idea how you have a program, you intend good things, and there are unintended consequences of the program. It kind of backfires, and it becomes very expensive. Who's going to be paying for all these inspectors and airplanes and photography and all of that? Cadet Faust?
Taxpayers.
The taxpayer. Taxes are going to go up to a top rate under Roosevelt of 79% in the 1930s. 79% is the top marginal rate. So now we're going to be telling our super entrepreneurs that they have to give $4 out of every $5 to the U.S. government. We discovered that very few people are inventing things. If you look at inventions and patents, we find very few in the 1930s. Just as we found a lot in the 1920s, very little in the 1930s. One of the ones I like to laugh at is the board game Monopoly was one of the inventions of the 30s. You know, you're broke, so go pass go and get $200 and that kind of thing. It excites people, and that's one of the inventions of the 1930s. But we don't find these inventions that create jobs like air conditioning and even zipper making or refrigerator making and this kind of thing. We don't find that outflow of creativity because people are reluctant to take risks when, in fact, they have to pay most of what they earn to the government if they're successful. Thus, we are in a deepening Great Depression. It persists throughout Roosevelt's first two terms. I want to talk about the WPA because, see, the question that often gets asked, well, wait a minute here. If this was so bad, how can this guy keep getting reelected? I mean, that's a very good question. Mallory, can I borrow the other book for a minute? In FDR Goes to War, thank you. I want to read and see if you can get this. This is the WPA, road building. See if you can get a clue how Roosevelt is being reelected. I thought it best just to quote some of these people and try to explain it by what they were going through, people who went through at the times, the 1930s, and were part of this whole process of elections and federal programs. V.G. Copeland was the Democratic Party county chairman in Indiana, the state of Indiana. And he says this. He's talking about the WPA. What I think will help is to change the WPA management from top to bottom. Put men in there who are in favor of using these Democratic projects to make votes for the Democratic Party. In other words, we target WPA projects. Everybody has roads they want built. The question is, what states and what districts are going to get those roads? And the answer is those who please President Roosevelt or those who are in swing states that President Roosevelt wants to carry. For example, the Democrats had not carried Pennsylvania, the state of Pennsylvania, in decades. Pennsylvania was targeted with a heavy amount of WPA spending. Bring those projects into the WPA. And what we found is David Lawrence, who was a newspaper, a magazine editor, a newspaper writer, did a survey of Pennsylvania, and he found that those counties in Pennsylvania that received no federal funds or limited federal funds in 1936 voted Republican. The more money you received, the more likely your county was to vote Democrat. And Roosevelt made sure that a lot of money went into Pennsylvania's big cities, Pittsburgh and Philadelphia, to go Democratic. Let me read some other quotations. This might help. This is a congressman, Frank Towey from New Jersey. And he said this. He's giving a speech. And here's what he says about the WPA. Congressman from New Jersey. In this county, there are 18,000 people on the WPA. With an average of three in a family, you have 54,000 potential Democratic votes. Can anyone beat that if it is properly mobilized? Yeah, it is interesting, isn't it? We have, for example, as we go into the 1940 election, where Roosevelt runs for a third term, the WPA is very strong. James Doherty, a New Hampshire Democrat, says this: "It is my personal belief that to the victor belong the spoils, and that Democrats should be holding most of those WPA positions so that we might strengthen our fences for the 1940 elections." And I'll just conclude this by a Southern senator. As you know, Southern senators were often part of the Democratic Party. We had the solid Democratic South. Carter Glass, one of Virginia's senior senator, said this. He was honest. He was talking about the overwhelming reelection of Franklin Roosevelt in 1936 with high unemployment in the United States. And he said this: "The 1936 elections would have been much closer had my party not had a $4.8 billion WPA relief bill as campaign fodder." Right? He saw it happen. I mean, they all saw it. They saw the money going out at election time. Sometimes people working in federal organizations were distributing campaign literature in October of 36. And he saw that overwhelming amount of federal aid going into the election and producing victories for the Democratic Party. What we had then is the Democratic Party able to win elections even though the policies were not getting us out of the Great Depression. And this is where we have that paradox that the policies are failing, but the president is able to continually win re-election. This is a huge change in American history. I wish the Southern agrarians would have written more on this, which apparently they did not quite see as threatening as the rise of industry. Interesting. Now, some of them did oppose this. I'm not suggesting that Robert Penn Warren was a huge fan of Roosevelt, but by writing a big novel against Huey Long, he was writing against Roosevelt's main opponent in the Democratic Party in his book, All the King's Men. And so I'm suggesting these people, the Southern agrarians, were not really as opposed to what was going on in the federal government, oddly enough, as they were with the industrial development, how that radio and air conditioning and that sort of thing, how that broke down barriers in the South. What we have is Franklin Roosevelt winning elections, but it's at a big cost because the taxes are going to have to go up. When we get into World War II, they really go up. We have in World War II, Roosevelt does not spend much to get us ready for the war effort. And we're not really ready at all. And when the Pearl Harbor attack comes, it takes the United States a long time to get ready. And Roosevelt's got to figure out, how do I get entrepreneurs to produce military equipment with these high tax rates? He has to make arrangements to help the entrepreneurs do something with the tax rates, at least temporarily during war, so that we can get entrepreneurs producing again. And I'm happy to say they did. We had incredible developments. You know, penicillin. Some of this was help from Great Britain, too. Radar. These kinds of things. Landing craft. Well, we have to give the Navy credit for something, don't we? Landing craft. The Navy, and this was interesting because we see an entrepreneurial flavor to this. The Navy had its own landing craft. And this is very important because when you're going to land that great army at Normandy and other places, right, to defeat Hitler, you have to have them land and not get picked off by the Germans. You can't have them land in major ports because those are the easiest for the Germans to get. The beauty of good landing craft is you can land in kind of rocky places and get ashore, and the Germans don't know where you're going to land. When we have Andrew Higgins invented landing craft that could bring 40 soldiers into shore, and the landing craft would stop short of the shore, they'd have to get out and then in water come to shore. But the point is, they could land almost anywhere instead of being limited to the ports. That landing craft that Andrew Higgins had, the Navy at first opposed. And then finally, the man who's going to become Vice President, Harry Truman, was head of a committee that were going to look at various military inventions, find out which ones work best, and adopt those. So it's not just going to be These guys have power, and they're going to impose their landing craft on the nation. You have to prove your landing craft is best before we'll use it. And the Navy, the landing craft that was developed by the Navy, had to go up against Higgins' landing craft. And Higgins, you have to give the guy credit. He said, okay, I'm going head-to-head against the Navy. And by the way, I'm going to have a boat on side because after I land my landing craft in and drop all my... They were doing it. They each had a tank. They didn't have soldiers. They were each going to do a tank and bring a tank from one point to another. He says, after I get my tank in, I want to have another boat there to catch the Navy's because they'll probably turn over. And that's exactly what happened. The Navy's turned over, and his came in to shore just fine. And Truman was outraged. He says, Navy, you need to be buying Higgins' landing craft. Dwight Eisenhower said, there is the man who won the war for us. He was that strong. And I'm happy to say, even in the Army, we had, and I have to give Roosevelt credit for this, he allowed General Marshall, Chief of Staff, to make decisions. He did, you know, the typical Roosevelt way would have been, oh, I want to carry Pennsylvania. Let's have this general from Pennsylvania conduct this battle. And so we go into Sicily with some general who has no experience. Instead, he says, no, I want to bring Patton in there. Right? Or he says, I want to have Eisenhower conduct the Normandy operation. And of course, he gets the right people in there. Roosevelt, I have to give him credit, stood aside and allowed General Marshall to look over hundreds of generals to bring in Eisenhower, who has just barely become a general. And when he was in his 50 years old and looked like someone who was just going to be a lifer, who was an officer but didn't have a particularly spectacular career, brought him in there to command the troops. We did get good people in good positions, and we won that war. Roosevelt was interested in raising the tax rate and did so, however, to 94%. 94% on all income over $200,000. Every dollar you earned over $200,000, you paid 94 cents of that dollar to the government and you kept 6 cents. When 1945 came and the bombs were dropped at Hiroshima and Nagasaki, Roosevelt had died by then, but his successors wanted to continue his programs. Roosevelt wanted programs to have massive continuation of federal intervention. Congress looked at that and said, our people fought this war. Our cadets, civilians who became soldiers, the 12 million and more who went overseas, they fought that war for freedom. They didn't fight that war so that 94% of everybody's earnings could be taken away. That's other people. That's not the United States. That's other people do that. That isn't what we do in this country. It's as though the honor, duty, and respect is so much part of the American culture that we want to fight that war to preserve it, even against fierce enemies on their home ground over in Europe. Yes, we give them the tools. We give them the tools. You know, we give them, you know, B-17s, we go to the B-24s, we begin to improve our tanks. We produce the ammunition and we do it. But we had people willing to go over there because they said, this country stands for something, it's worth it. That type of commitment, I think, helped a little bit with Congress after the war saying, what direction do we want to go? And this is my final point. What direction are we going to go? Are we going to go with the big spending end of Franklin Roosevelt and have a new batch of federal programs? And he wanted them. He wanted a federal housing authority. His argument was everybody has a right to, quote, a decent home. Which is interesting because if Cadet Bell has a right to a decent home, then Cadet Ford has an obligation to pay for Cadet Bell with his decent home. That's very different from freedom of speech, isn't it? Now, you people, unfortunately, are locked in. You have to hear me. But those people out there could walk out in our audience anytime. Freedom of speech does not impose obligations of others even to sit around and Lincoln. Listen, least of all to pay for it. Freedom of religion does not mean you have to pay for anybody's church. But if Cadet Bell has a right to a decent home, then all of us have an obligation to finance that home. And by the way, what is a decent home? Well, I mean, of course, air conditioning. If you're in Charleston. But we didn't have home air conditioning much in 1940s. So you can see the bureaucrats are going to be changing the definition all the time. It's going to be an incredible boondoggle. That is the direction that Franklin Roosevelt wanted to head. And they said, if you don't have government jobs to build people these homes and have more types of WPA projects, we're going to go huge into unemployment. Sidney Hillman, who was head of the CIO, you know, the old AFL-CIO, back then the CIO was separate. Sidney Hillman, head of the CIO, said, if you don't have a lot of programs and have them quick, the soldiers are going to come home and you're going to have 10 million unemployed in 6 to 10 weeks. Senator Harley Kilgore of West Virginia said, no, it's going to be 18 million. We're going to have unemployment worse than the Great Depression. 12 million soldiers are going to come home and there's nothing for them. Congress, led by Senator Walter George of Georgia, Senator Democrat, Senator Albert Hawks of New Jersey, a Republican, led the charge to cut federal taxation, cut federal spending, and they even cited what Coolidge, Andrew Mellon, the Secretary of Treasury, and Harding and others did in the 1920s. George said, I was senator back in the 20s. I saw what happened. Let's go that route. We cut federal spending by two-thirds after the war. We cut the corporate income tax from 90% to 38%. We cut the income tax. We told people, you're going to get to keep more of what you produce. We're going to trust Americans with the freedom they went overseas to fight and earn. With the results and take our chances. Rather than empowering government bureaucrats and czars with power to allocate federal funds taken from taxpayers, we're going to cut the tax rates and turn people loose. Unemployment in 1946 and 1947, the 2 years after the war, it was the same in both years. 3.9%. We assimilated 12 million people back in with an incredible expansion by American entrepreneurs. Many of these inventions we take for granted today and developments. I mean, television had been invented before the war, but it became increasingly popular after the war. Xerox machines, copy machines, fast food, McDonald's, Holiday Inns, a slew of inventions are going to come forth, rivaling the 1920s. Plus, we get a lot of those inventions we had in the 1920s, like air conditioning. We're going to have expansion of those. Automobiles, all of that coming forth. We bring 12 million soldiers home, and we get jobs for all of them because of the expansionist economy with entrepreneurs who are willing to take risks and willing to take chances. That is what ended the Great Depression. Giving people more freedom, not empowering government bureaucrats. That is the story of overcoming the New Deal and Franklin Roosevelt. Thank you.